Hello, this is Justin from TED Learning. Welcome to the next in our series of podcasts on lived experiences. Today, we explore neurodiversity. So welcome to this podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Justine and Chris. Both are neurodivergent. Chris Bonello is an autistic advocate, award-winning writer and international speaker, also a novelist and special needs tutor. In 2015, he launched Autistic Not Weird to share his insights from both a personal and professional perspective. Justine Baylis is a recent graduate from the University of Arts London, where she studied fashion PR and communications. She's passionate about advocating for neurodivergent individuals, and her final year project was dedicated to this part of her identity, centred around her own business idea to better support neurodivergent staff. Today we'll be exploring their lived experiences from both an educational and work perspective. So Justine and Chris, welcome.
Hi.
So Chris, we'll start with you if we may. Can you just share a little bit about your personal journey and when you first learned that you were neurodivergent?
Okay, well, my first assessment for autism was at the age of four, but that was back in 1989. The movie Rain Man had only been out for about a year, so we were very, very far back in time in terms of our understanding of autism. So I didn't get the diagnosis until I was 25 in January 2011, when they finally said, oh yeah, Chris, sorry, you've been autistic your whole life. We just didn't know until now.
And how did you feel when they said that to you?
Well, I always knew I was different, so it was nice to actually have an explanation for it. That there was about a year and a bit between me finding out I was autistic and me getting the diagnosis for it. Finding out I was autistic really helped me to contextualize a lot about the life that I'd lived to that point, and also helped me to make peace with the fact that I wasn't the wrong kind of person, because I wasn't like everyone else. In fact, all those efforts to try and become like everyone else hadn't been fixing me, that had actually been damaging me. The diagnosis, that was nice, because I had a lot of people who, even including those with best intentions, were saying, oh, but you don't know you're autistic, you just think it. And yeah, having an actual diagnosis from a consultant psychiatrist did actually help as a nice counter-argument. But frankly, I don't think you should need a consultant psychiatrist to tell people that actually, yes, I have lived experience of being autistic and I do know what it's like.
And what does it mean to you to be autistic?
Well, from my perspective, it just feels completely normal. But one of the things that I value about being autistic is the fact that I have the kind of brain that comes up with the kind of ideas that a lot of other people don't come up with. And this comes at the expense of not noticing the things that other people think of as extremely obvious. So there is a certain level of trade-off, but the trade-off is entirely worth it if you're in an environment that values the brains that think differently. Unfortunately, it is quite common for autistic people, again, those who come up with the ideas that no one else comes up with, but misses the really obvious things that other people come up with, they end up thinking of their brains as inferior simply because everyone obsessively, pathologically focuses on their weaknesses and what's missing from them, rather than focusing on the value that they do actually bring to society.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but you've mentioned a couple of times that your brain will think of things in a different way. Can you give me an example of maybe where you might approach something differently to someone who isn't neurodivergent?
Excel spreadsheets, probably. I have spreadsheets for absolutely everything. I have spreadsheets for things that need to be done around the house. I have spreadsheets for all the recipes of everything that I know how to cook. I'm going to look at what spreadsheets I've opened right now. There's one for my income and finances, obviously. There's one for weight loss as well. I track my weight loss using Microsoft Excel, and it's brilliant because it's nice and ordered and is made up of numbers, and there's no room for ambiguity unless I were to want there to be some level of flexibility and ambiguity. And I could geek out. I could spend this whole session just geeking out about Excel spreadsheets. But other people often just do things, you know, by instinct and or don't make things measurable. And that's not really how my brain personally works. I like to keep things very specific and measurable. And frankly, I don't think that's something that's problematic or needs pathologizing. I think that's a totally valid way to access the world.
Yeah, it's just a different perspective on how to manage things. And Justine, when did you first learn that you were neurodivergent, and how did that impact you?
First of all, I just want to say on the spreadsheet front, I don't know how to use Excel because it just looks confusing, but I'm a sucker for a table. I love a table. I love so as soon as you said that, I was like, yep, that is exactly me. But for me, my journey, I guess, my neurodivergent journey, it's only relatively recent. When I started uni 3 years ago, I, by chance or by fate, whatever you want to call it, I happened to be looking at the signs and symptoms of ADHD. And so I'm sitting there looking through this list and I'm thinking, okay, that is really familiar. That sounds like me. And so from that, then I got assessed through my uni, reached out to the disability service, had an assessment, and also found out that I'm also dyslexic, which was a little curveball. Especially because I didn't actually know that much about dyslexia. I had a stereotype in my head of what dyslexia meant, and it was completely different to how I viewed myself. So yeah, basically from that point, found out that I was most likely had ADHD. I don't have any formal diagnosis yet, but I am on a couple of waiting lists for ADHD and also autism, because just as my I guess my knowledge expanded since finding out 3 years ago, I started to notice quite a lot of autistic traits in myself as well. And so, yeah, that's currently where I'm at. So, yeah, relatively recent is when my journey started with all this stuff.
And what sort of, you said you started to notice some traits. What sort of things did you notice that made you think that you might be autistic?
I've always been a bit, I don't know what the word would be, but maybe a bit quirky, a bit different. I've always kind of felt different, which I think is what Chris said earlier on. I've always kind of felt a little bit different to like those around me, maybe not perceiving things in the exact way that other people perceive them. I've always been very kind and empathetic, not really understood why people are horrible, for instance. I also have quite a lot of like very specific interests that just like, made me think, wow, this makes sense. I also would suffer with quite bad social anxiety. I find it quite difficult to carry on conversations, which is ironic because I actually can talk for Britain, which is thanks to my ADHD. But then I guess the other side of me comes in where I'm like, unless I'm talking about something that I'm majorly passionate about, I fall a bit short when I'm there like, I don't really know what's going on now. So yeah, small talk. It's not for me. I'm not one for small talk. I prefer very deep conversations or conversations about things that I'm very interested about.
Chris, as an advocate for neurodivergency, is there a difference between the words autistic and neurodivergent?
One of them is basically a subset of the other. I mean, it's, I think according to the strict definition, you can be neurodivergent whilst being non-autistic. For example, a dyslexic non-autistic person is neurodivergent. But according to the definition, you can't be a non-neurodivergent autistic person because autism is a neurodivergence. So it's kind of like, think of a Venn diagram Venn-ish diagram, where you've got this big circle that is neurodivergence. Then you've got all these circles in the middle. One of them's autism, one of them's dyslexia, one of them's ADHD. And of course, there's a lot of overlap because, as Justine was just saying, it is absolutely possible to have multiple neurodivergences. In fact, I would say if you're one type of divergent, that increases the likelihood of you being another type of divergent. In fact, not necessarily neurodivergent in terms of everything I was just saying. You may be divergent in terms of whether you're LGBT plus or trans or all these other ways in which people diverge from what has often been known and characterized as the general human experience. So if you're divergent from the mean, to put it mathematically in one way, you are more likely than the general population to be divergent in other ways as well. And that's why I heard somewhere, and I'll admit I don't have the statistics to back this up, but I've heard multiple times there are more autistic people with ADHD than there are autistic people without ADHD.
Okay.
And the more autistic people I come to know, the more believable that seems.
And what made you set up your website, Autistic Not Weird?
Well, after I left teaching forever for the first time, I've left teaching forever twice, and this time I do actually mean it. The context being, in a previous life, I was a primary school teacher. I left at the end of December 2014, and then I ended up doing some work with students outside of education. One contact led to another contact, one contact led to a special school, and then ended up being a teacher again in a school specifically for autistic students, and that was so much better for me personally. And but in that gap between the two, it didn't take me long after I'd left mainstream teaching to realise how much I missed the opportunities to build people up, to offer guidance to people who needed it. I mean, I was still volunteering through my local Boys Brigade company, so I was still having a positive impact on a local scale. But there was a lot of good that I knew that I wasn't doing by keeping my autism, well, diagnosed Asperger's, I just call it autism now, by keeping that to myself. So I thought, well, you know what, why not share my insights? And 173,000 Facebook followers later and several published books, I'm kind of glad that I made the decision to come out as being autistic publicly. But I wouldn't say automatically that everyone needs to be public with their autism. I think there's a lot of pressure on people to, once they learn they're autistic, they're supposed to be fighting for the cause or something. But no, the first thing you need to be doing is looking after yourself. If you want to be a closet autistic person because that's what you're comfortable with, do that. That's fine. That was me for about 4 years after I learned I was autistic. But if you really feel that you have something to add to the discussion, more voices are, well, more powerful than fewer voices. But yeah, that would be my advice to people who are also looking to advocate. And I know I'm veering from the question you originally asked, but that was my journey. It does not have to be your journey, but pick whatever works for you and advocate as much or as little as you feel that you are able to do.
And a question for both of you. Are there any misconceptions that you hear or see from people towards someone who's neurodivergent?
Fortunately, I've not actually experienced personally that many misconceptions as such. More so, I guess, confusion and just a general lack of awareness with like family and friends and stuff. So I guess I'm lucky on that front. And I assume that maybe has something to do with the fact that, you know, it's only been a reality for me fairly recently. But I guess one consensus that I've sort of come across, especially with ADHD, is that it's mostly about hyperactivity. Which is just one part of it. You can have ADHD and not be hyperactive at all, which in that sense you are likely to be what's known as inattentive, which comes with, you know, things like easily distracted, normally labeled a bit of a daydreamer, forgetfulness, things like that. So yeah, I think fortunately, yeah, I've personally not, but I know that there are many misconceptions, especially with women. Like, going back to sort of a previous point that I made, I only recently found out that this was my reality, and that is a very common experience for women, neurodivergent women, because there tends to be a lot, well, there's more research around boys and men, neurodivergent-wise. There's still not a whole heap, there's not a whole load of it, but there is more for men and women. And so that in itself comes with misconceptions.
I agree, especially about the women bits. Did you know that only boys can have autism? That's me being sarcastic. Oh, yeah, that's another misconception. We don't know how to be sarcastic.
Sarcasm is my second language, so that's completely not true. That's
Oddly enough, that is. Yeah, that's literally the wording that I use. I literally use that wording. I speak sarcasm as a second language.
Justin, as what you just to respond to what you just said, it is a genuine misconception, along with like not being able to understand humor, things like that. But I love comedy. I love stand-up comedy. Like, I very much do understand it. I think with like most people, neurodivergent or neurotypical, there's always going to be slight nuances that you're not going to understand. But is that even, first of all, my fault? Are you just not being clear? That's a whole thing in itself. But yeah, no, there is definitely a misconception that we maybe don't understand humor or sarcasm, which is completely the opposite of me and anyone that I know who's also neurodivergent, to be honest. They're the funniest people that I know, if anything.
I find that the reason that so many stereotypes exist about autism and neurodivergence is because we like to make things simple for ourselves. So we would prefer it if all autistic people didn't understand sarcasm, didn't understand humor, this, that, and the other. Now, my stepdaughter, I'd hesitate before saying struggles with sarcasm. She can detect sarcasm, but she will need a little bit of extra time to process that, this is non-literal, because the taking things literally thing is very real. A lot of us do struggle with sarcasm and I'm not going to say struggle with humor, because we all have senses of humor, but it depends whether the humor is accessible. But it becomes a problem when stereotypes are formed based on, well, you're autistic. That means that you need to match all these stereotypes. And I do feel like a bit of a hypocrite here, because I match a lot of Asperger syndrome stereotypes. Like, first off, I'm a white male, and I also have a maths degree, and I can also solve a Rubik's Cube. There are a lot of stereotypes that I fit. And one of the big misconceptions is that all autistic people are supposed to either be like me, or they're supposed to be like my stepdaughter. For example, there's me, high functioning. I'm basically not allowed to struggle with things. I often say that I am very high functioning, except when I'm not. And then there's Eliza, who, when I first met her at the age of 7, she had learning difficulties across the board, academically speaking, except for reading, because she had a reading age of 10. So, hold on, am I supposed to call her high functioning or low functioning? This doesn't fit with my stereotypical view of autism. So, yeah, there's some people like me who aren't allowed to struggle, and there's people like Eliza who aren't allowed to succeed according to the stereotypes.
And is the expression on the spectrum is something that I've heard people talk about. And I remember I deliver a lot of inclusion and diversity training, and was talking about autism and neurodivergency. And someone said, oh, well, everyone's on the spectrum. And I was like, no, that's not actually the case at all. It's quite an offensive comment. And obviously, for those people that are listening to this podcast, I can see, Chris, your reaction on screen. How does that make you feel when either of you hear, oh, well, everyone's a bit on the spectrum?
Frustrated. Yeah, I understand that that's going to be the consensus, and I understand that people say that, but it's so far from true, and it's really damaging, actually, because it sort of minimises the struggles which do come with being neurodivergent or being autistic. I don't know if Chris has anything else to add to that.
Yeah, I basically agree with everything you said, and the fact that sometimes it's meant as a well-meaning comment, like, oh, you're autistic, we're all on the spectrum somewhere. There you go. As intended as a way of saying you're not alone, when really it just kind of trivialises it. But it's also weaponized. I've heard of people who have had their daughters or themselves, these largely being women, big surprise, who have been refused a diagnosis by doctors because, well, we're all on the spectrum somewhere. And yeah, if it's someone who I know to be well-meaning, I try not to be too belittling to them, because you don't want to discourage people's kindness. So I have a bit of a humorous twist on it. I say that the fact that we're all on the autism spectrum, that doesn't mean we're all a little autistic, because there's a very subtle difference between the two of them. And then I talk about facts that are technically true, but hugely misleading. For example, did you know I am undefeated in professional boxing. Totally true, but massively misleading because I've never boxed in my life. did you know that Mars is entirely populated by robots? Technically true, but very misleading. Did you know that, what's another good one? Oh yeah, you can go without drinking for the rest of your life. You'd die after a couple of days, but you would have gone without drinking for the rest of your life. And here's another one. Did you know we are all on the autism spectrum? Because, well, the definition of a spectrum, it contains 100% of people, but I've heard lots of people saying that there's a gender spectrum as well, and 100% of humans will be on that. A spectrum, by definition, contains everyone and everything, by everything that falls into the category under discussion. And that the autism spectrum may contain all people, but the vast majority of people would essentially score zero. So no, we're not all a little bit autistic. It just doesn't work that way. And then I often finish with a bit of a punchline. Well, I say punchline, it's more of a gut punch, but if we were all a little autistic, the world would be kinder to autistic people.
Well,
which is the biggest evidence that we are not all autistic is the fact that the world still is totally inhospitable to most autistic people.
Yeah.
And what does that look like? So if just to pick up on that point, that the world is inhospitable towards autistic people, what sort of negative things have you seen or experienced? Chris, if I can start with you from a work perspective, and then Justine, I'll come to you.
Glad you asked that, because I was just thinking of my students. So most recently, up until last year, I taught in a school for autistic students. And a lot of the time, it was a matter of very first things first, before you try teaching them anything academic, you make them feel like they belong there, because they will have gone to, well, the vast majority of them did not come to that school with a positive backstory. A lot of them will have not felt that sense of belonging in other schools. A lot of them will have been let down by adults, grown-ups with qualifications. And because these are grown-ups with qualifications and experts in their field that say that the whole thing is the fault of the child's behaviour, then they learn falsely that it's all their fault. And the system is delighted that these students come to our school blaming themselves rather than blaming the system that made them so anxious and gave them such an inferiority complex in the first place. They come to us feeling like they failed mainstream, when the reality is mainstream education failed them.
As somebody who's been in work for a few years now, what sort of things have you personally experienced as an autistic adult?
Would you mind being a bit more specific with the question?
Yeah, of course. So you mentioned that the world can be inhospitable towards autistic people. Have you experienced that as an employee anywhere that you've worked?
Yeah, in the middle of me being a primary school teacher, I took a bit of a break from primary school teaching and worked as a teaching assistant in a special school. And I remember, again, some of the colleagues were a bit rubbish, but most of them were very good, nice people. I'm thinking right now of a teacher who would explain the task to the students, and once she'd finished and set them off on their work, she would then turn to me and explain the task again to me with the same slow voice and intonations as she just talked to the students with. And I was a qualified primary school teacher with a mathematics degree by this point. But apparently, that's how you talk to autistic people, all of us. And at that same school, I ran a chess club. I used to be a huge, huge chess geek before I moved on to Rubik's Cubes. And I ran lots of chess clubs in lots of mainstream schools and some special schools as well. And when I did it in mainstream education, I was known as Mr. Bonello the Chess Geek. And I rocked that reputation. It was a great reputation to have. But it wasn't until I did exactly the same thing in special education that a minority of staff said, oh, well, you're only doing it because you're autistic and it's your autistic obsession. No, it really is, because I've seen the good that chess can do for young people. It's basically the total opposite of an impulsive game. It makes you think about actions and consequences, and it makes you stop and think. It's actually pretty good for handling anxiety as well. But that's a huge geek out for another time. But because I was autistic, it must be because it's your autistic obsession.
Okay. And Justine, you've just finished your qualification. What was your educational experience like as somebody who's neurodivergent?
So you've got the whole, you've got to consider the whole before I even knew. Like, I got quite far into education before I even knew that I was neurodivergent. Always been labelled a chatterbox since basically day dot. Sort of semi-disruptive from quite early on, not in like a typically naughty way, but because I wanted to talk to anyone and everyone who was around me, I would sometimes be moved to other next to other people. That did nothing, because I will carry on talking regardless of who it is. I will talk, because I can talk about, you know, I can talk. I guess that's like the real thing that sticks out to me. I can't think of it. I'm sure there is other
things.
Were
they supportive to you? Were they, you know, once your diagnosis had taken place, did you feel that you got the right level of support at the university to help you through to completing your final project?
So yeah, with university, once I found out that it was my reality and that was the case with me, the disability team at my uni were amazing. I got given, you know, adjustments, extra time for my deadlines, because, you know, time management isn't always my best friend. And so that sort of like leniency I got given. I got given a one-to-one study skills tutor who I'm not sure if I would have got through uni without her, because she was amazing. I had sessions, you know, mostly once a week, to help me with my assignments and stuff. Generally, the teaching staff, they were always pretty willing to learn, which I think is potentially quite a unique experience. I can't speak for other people, but I feel like it might be a unique experience relatively. They were always pretty keen to understand, to listen, never really belittled anything that I said if I did try to advocate for myself and other students. And it's even resulted in one of my tutors, my third year tutor, actually wanting to work with me after uni to help develop lesson planning to make it more like accessible for neurodivergent students. And so, yeah, I guess that speaks to like my uni experience. Once I found out that it was my reality, it all kind of made sense. And I was very fortunate enough to have quite a good experience. There was definitely some like odd hiccups along the way of like, hey, well, this doesn't feel very accessible or helpful. But fortunately, I think I've always been the sort of person who isn't afraid to speak up. And that is, I understand that I'm very fortunate in that sense, because that's, you know, not the same for everyone. But yeah, I felt pretty good, and I'm grateful for the support that I did actually get, because I know it could have been worse.
And what are your hopes for work?
That's a good question. In terms of like being a neurodivergent individual?
Yeah, I mean, if we go back to Chris's example just then of the teacher that took, you know, the sort of same tone as she'd spoken to the students with him, and some of the comments that were being made to him about, well, it's because you're autistic that that's an obsession. That's his lived experience in work. What do you hope your work experience will look and feel like? And part two to that question is, how would you challenge maybe that behavior towards you?
Hey, you might have to ask me the second part of that question again, because I'm very likely
of
to.
Of course.
In true ADHD form, what was the first bit you actually asked me?
So what are your hopes for work?
Okay. See, I'm being very reflective of ADHD. I'm going to be my authentic self. And yeah, I'm very likely to keep forgetting what you're saying, but what am I expecting from, right, okay, cool. I guess an employer who is kind, first of all. I'm a very big advocate for kindness. And I think that if everyone had a bit more kindness, it would make everyone's lives a lot easier, but especially those who are neurodivergent. Patience is a huge thing, a huge, huge thing. And I think on that note, it's important to say that not all of the adjustments and accommodations are hugely tangible or physical things. There is obviously definitely physical accommodations which can be made, but I think a lot of it is just your mindset, your perception, your willingness to, you know, listen to my and your other neurodivergent staff's needs, listen to, take me seriously. Don't just do it because you feel like you have to, like really compassion. I want compassion from you. I understand a lot of these things might be, what would the phrase be? Like wishful thinking maybe, because I understand the reality of that is that might not always be the case. But for me, I hope that my future employers have all them things, kindness, patience, a willingness to, you know, adapt and accommodate me. And yeah, I think that's what comes to my mind.
And then the second part of the question was, go on, Chris, go for it.
Sorry. So may I add one of my own wishes for you in the workplace? At the beginning of your answer, you said, I'm going to be my authentic self here and just answer as the person I am. I hope that the workplaces that you have in the future do enable you to be your authentic self and that you don't have to spend your time pretending to be neurotypical because of other people's, whether work expectations or social expectations. That experience has taught me that the ability to be authentic in the workplace is enormously valuable. So I hope that you find a place for that as well.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, somewhere that I can be authentic. And fortunately, one of my positive traits is that if I'm not happy somewhere, I will leave. And whilst I'll be patient and give someone some, I'll give grace, I will leave if I don't feel like you're allowing me to be my true self, because life's far too short to not be yourself and far too long to not be yourself. So yeah, exactly, Chris, you're right. Somewhere that will take me as I am and will accept me for who I am, 100%.
And Chris, just to go back to that point of employers should want people to be their authentic self, what advice would you give to employers about how to create that more inclusive place to work, particularly for neurodivergent employees?
When you say that your workplace values neurodivergent people, it's one thing to say that kind of thing, but help us to believe it. There's something I say to teach trainers, that there's no point in memorizing the procedure for making a safeguarding referral if you haven't created the kind of environment where a child actually feels safe enough around you to come up to you and talk about these things. And the parallel there with work is that, oh yeah, going back to stereotypes, did you know that autistic people don't know how to lie? Well, yeah, again, false stereotype, we do know how to lie. We just struggle with being inauthentic, which I'd argue is a strength. But the little caveat to that is that often we are taught to be people pleasers. So if you go to, well, let's go back to the school example, a child in school who does not feel safe in school, and you ask them, do you feel safe in school? That child might just say, yes, I do, because that's the expected answer. If you go to an autistic employee and you haven't created that kind of environment where you do listen and the employee knows that things that get listened to also get acted on, if you haven't created that environment, then there's at least some likelihood that the person will just tell you what you want to hear. Because after all, we're taught from an early age that that's how you avoid being in trouble. You tell people what they want to hear.
And do you think society has got better in its understanding of autism and neurodivergency, or do you think there's still a long way to go?
Can I say both?
You can.
I ran a survey on autismnotweird.com, and it's had more than 11,000 respondents worldwide. And one of the things I did, well, it asked questions about most hot topics in autism, everything from ABA to language choices to experiences in employment to experience in schools. And one thing that surprised me a bit was when I filtered out the results for the question, strongly agree to strongly disagree, my experience in school was a positive one. I filtered the responses from the adults and saw that, as you'd expect, the majority gave negative responses to that, with a minority of positive responses. And then I filtered out the responses for the age 19 or under and got almost exactly the same responses. The percentage differences were basically statistical noise. What that tells me, unfortunately, is that even though we are more aware of autism and we know more about it and the drive is there, sincerely or otherwise, the drive is there to improve the school experience for neurodivergent children, it's implying that there hasn't actually been that much change to the school environment and how welcoming it is or otherwise to neurodivergent students. So we have come a long way in terms of we now know what we should be doing. The long way to go is the fact that we need to actually do it.
And over the last couple of podcasts, I've been interviewing other people who have different lived experiences, so are based on different protective characteristics under the Equality Act. And one of the consistent messages that they've all come back with is that if people who are Black or trans or gay or lesbian or disabled see representation in the media of themselves, that makes their lived experience, their life, a bit easier. How do you feel the media presents neurodivergency and autism at the moment?
I think it's increasingly common to see representations of neurodivergent people in the media, specifically more so autism, I'm feeling at the moment. But I, from my perspective, I think that a lot of it is largely exaggerated, especially where like non-fictional characters sort of are. I understand that, I guess, part of that is because they're acting and, you know, you want to come across in a certain way. But it would be interesting to see the other more slightly subtle nuances of being neurodivergent, which might go undetected, especially in women. And then I guess on that note as well, I feel like there's maybe more media representation on boys and men. I think I don't really see many neurodivergent representation of women in the media. So I think that's something to consider. But yeah, I think it's becoming more common because I think it's a bit of a, I worry it's a bit of a trend at the moment. I hope that it's not, and I hope that it's everlasting. But yeah, I'm noticing maybe some of it's slightly exaggerated. Whilst it's great that it is becoming more common in media and mainstream media, I would like it to be a bit more realistic, a bit more maybe considering the the crossovers of people's identity and how that plays into being neurodivergent and more women. So yeah, more, I want it to be more realistic, and more women would be great. Also, not just women, but also non-binary people as well, because that's a huge crossover.
Okay. Yeah. Well, rather hilariously, the day that we're filming this podcast happens to be the day where my first illustrated children's book has been released. It's one released through HarperCollins' division that puts books into schools. You know, those are Red Band, Green Band, Pearl Band books and so on. And they commissioned me to write a story with an autistic main character. It's called Alfie Smith Speed Cuber, and it's about an 11-year-old autistic boy who rediscovers his confidence through speed-solving Rubik's Cubes. And what really impressed me about going through the publication process was that when Collins Big Cats, like the division of HarperCollins that publishes these books, when they were running this series on neurodivergent main characters, you can tell that they meant it. They actually wanted not just neurodivergent children to read this and think, oh, wow, it's like this person who's like me is in a book. It's also useful for neurotypical children to understand that, it doesn't have to be the neurotypical person who isn't really divergent in any kind of area who gets to be the hero. I mean, so there are ways where it can be done responsibly, and I've been very encouraged whilst going through the publication process. And One reason why I think it's very important is because I happen to have a copy of Underdogs right here. So this is my novel series, and it's neurodivergent dystopia. Basically, the whole of Britain's been imprisoned in these giant walled cities. They're being guarded by a million or so clone soldiers. And there are only 13 people who remain free in the abandoned countryside, fighting back against this army of a million. Most of them are teenagers who escaped an attack on their special school. So it's got autistic heroes, dyslexic heroes, who has ADHD, anxiety, Down syndrome, and so on. And it's very, very deliberately written as a means of neurodivergent representation. And I'm very, very happy with the response it's got. But the thing that came to mind when I was just talking about non-neurodivergent people reading about characters who are different to them, I'm remembering when just about the only time I've sold that book at an event that had absolutely nothing to do with autism, a very friendly guy came up to the stall and said, "Oh, Underdogs, what's that about?" So I told him exactly what I told you, and his response was, "Oh, sounds really interesting. Is it for charity?" And that, again, well-meaning response. He wasn't a nasty person at all. He was just a general nice guy who has been taught to believe that why would anyone write anything about neurodivergent characters unless there was some act of kindness involved, some kind of philanthropy or some kind of charitable involvement. So he was quite surprised when I told him that actually I'm an author by trade and I'm an autistic author who writes about neurodivergent heroes. I mean, wow, you're allowed to do that? So you can actually have neurodivergent people as heroes just in general? And so what do you mean you're not doing anything with the proceeds of this charitable event that you're doing? So yeah, it's hugely important that neurodivergent representation is both done responsibly and accurately and with the involvement of autistic people. They even commissioned HarperCollins, they even commissioned an autistic illustrator for this book with an autistic main character. But also it's so important for people who, to their knowledge, have no connection to neurodivergence to read stories about people who are different. Because right now, apparently, it's not supposed to happen. And we need to change that.
On that note about like on-screen media, in books, media, any sort of media representation is amazing. But, and I guess this sort of in a way relates to what I've learned during my degree studying fashion, is that if you're going to represent people on screen and in books and whatever you're producing, you better make sure that there's people behind the scenes that are being represented as well, that are being given the jobs and, you know, being put forward for these things as well. Like, so you've got the two sides of it, the on screen and in books and the sort of public facing media representation, and then behind the scenes. It needs to go both ways, because that's how you get the accuracy in the representation too, because, you know, it's no good really being represented through the lens of someone who doesn't have that lived experience at all, which ties perfectly into the title of this podcast series, I guess.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that was echoed in one of our earlier podcasts that we were recording when we were talking about race with two of our team who are Black, saying it's great that there's more Black representation on screen, but there needs to be more Black writers and directors and producers to help understand that lived experience. And that's the point that you've just echoed there, Justine. And Chris, your books sound amazing. I hope they're hugely successful. And I think it's such an important point that you're making, which is for, you know, neurotypical children to also recognize that people can be different, and that if we can teach that from an early age, we can get people to be more compassionate. And that leads to my last but one question, which is, how can neurotypical individuals be better allies to people who are neurodivergent?
Listen to us. Don't just listen and remember, and also believe us. There was this one time when I was giving a speech at a conference for healthcare workers, and I was very conscious that, well, I've got my autistic brain. Yes, I'm an autistic person, but I'm not every autistic patient that they're going to have. So I was very keen on having autistic voices or autistic contributions to that speech that weren't just mine. So I went to Autism Not Weird's Facebook page and I asked, so I'm going to be giving a speech at this conference. Is there anything that you'd like healthcare professionals to understand about the autistic experience? And the one that stuck with me for about 4 or 5 years now, ever since that conference speech, was the follower who said, and guess what? She was a woman. The follower who said that when she shared her own experiences, her own expertise, her own lived experience, the doctors weren't very quick to believe her. And the sentence that really stuck with me was that at the end of her comment, she said, we autistic people, we are often very good at being honest. We're just not very good at being believed. And the moment you learn that someone is neurodivergent or someone is autistic or someone's disabled or someone has learning difficulties, there is this doubt in a lot of people's heads, I'll say most people's heads, should I really be trusting this person given that they're different, including if the difference is something like learning difficulties or an intellectual disability or something. Oh, okay, that means that I automatically know better than all of them about everything because society teaches me that I have to. I'm not going to be thicker than someone with an intellectual disability, surely. That I have to know better than them about everything. I can't be inferior to those people. That's shameful. That is what society teaches us that our approach should be. So, yeah, hear us and believe us, even if, and perhaps especially if, we have learning difficulties or other things that would trigger your instinct to find us less reliable sources on our own lives.
On that, to add to that, I think all you've said is amazing, Chris. I'm really going to keep plugging kindness, if I'm completely honest with you, because I think by being better, by being kind, patient, you know, willingness to understand ideas which aren't maybe aligned with your own or typical to how you live your life, that makes such a difference to everyone, you know, not just neurodivergent individuals, but if we all just practice being a bit more kinder and a bit more patient and just having that willingness to take in things which are different to you helps everyone, especially neurodivergent people, especially anyone who's, you know, disadvantaged by society as a whole. And so, yeah, I will keep plugging kindness because I'm a strong believer that that is the root of like what would make everything better. as cliche and as sort of, I guess, that sounds.
I don't think it's cliche at all. I think a point that both of you have made really eloquently is that quite often people don't set out to offend. You know, most people don't wake up in the morning and think, I'm going to go to work and I'm going to offend and upset people deliberately. But the reality is that can be the intent. And sometimes it's through lack of ignorance or understanding. So I think that goes back to Chris's point of listening and believing. And yes, being compassionate, having empathy and being kind are really important traits for people to have. And if people can go to work and be at university and just go about their lives being more compassionate towards other human beings, recognizing that we're not all the same. You know, people are very different and very individual. And that's what makes life so interesting and so colourful and so exciting and embracing all of that difference. So my final question to both of you is, what advice would you give to somebody who is finding out for the first time that they are neurodivergent?
You might notice that things will start to make sense now. Your reality is going to change slightly, but hopefully for the better. Hopefully you can maybe now stop beating yourself up for things which are, dare I say it, normal to you, normal to your reality. In a more practical way, I guess, if you're on social media, then find activists and pages who resonate with you, because to me personally, that's been very empowering. Maybe that's just because I'm Gen Z, so I'm of that kind of mindset. But most importantly, be gentle with yourself, because finding out you are neurodivergent, whilst it can be insanely freeing, it can bring up a whole host of emotions. And just that kindness that you want other people to give out, just give it to yourself, you know, have some patience with yourself, and just be kind to yourself, really, overall.
I'm going to give a bit of a lazy answer. Lazy for two reasons. First off, it's exactly what Justine just said. I was literally about to say, be kind to yourself. And the other one is refer to something that I've already written on autistic.weird.com. If you go into the bit that says all articles, there's literally an article that I wrote called "I Just Found Out I'm Autistic, What Do I Do Now?" And I'm trying to remember the specific advice I gave there. One of them is take some time to learn things about it. There was a follower who messaged Autistic Not Weird a little while ago who said, "Chris, I've just found out I'm autistic. Any tips on how to become a motivational..." No, I found out 2 weeks ago that I'm autistic. Do you have any tips on how to become a motivational speaker? And there's no faulting that person's enthusiasm. That is great. But I had to tell them that take some time over it. Do some reflection about it. This time next year, or in my case, this time in 4 years' time, you'll be able to express the autistic experience much better than you currently can. And don't beat yourself up for not getting it straight away. Just like Justine said, find your community, find other people with shared experiences, and look after yourself first and foremost. And also remember, you're exactly the same person now as you were before you found out you're autistic. This hasn't, okay, maybe it has to, but the realization of it may have changed your perspective, but your brain hasn't suddenly turned autistic. There's nothing new to deal with other than the news, this new information that you need to process. So the things that have worked for you in the past will still work for you. So yeah, take things slowly, talk to trustworthy people, be kind to yourself.
I think also, just to add to that quickly, be prepared to challenge your own misconceptions. Because I know, especially with me being like, I guess, not insanely far into my life, but you know, in my 20s before I even knew this was my life, I had a lot of misconceptions about what it meant to be autistic or to have ADHD or to be dyslexic. And again, be patient with yourself, familiarize yourself with what it means in the best way that you can. But yeah, be prepared that you might actually have to challenge some feelings and misconceptions that you have. And that is okay, because it's all about learning. No one's perfect. That's the other thing as well. No one's perfect, and you are yourself. And yeah, be kind to yourself and to everyone.
Justine, Chris, thank you so much for your time today to talk us about your individual lived experience. It's been a genuine pleasure to talk to you both. Chris, we'll put a link to the website and to the books when the podcast goes out. Justine, stick to that rule of making sure that if somewhere doesn't treat you right, that you do go and find another place to work, because I think it's so important. I love that expression, life's too short and life's too long. That really resonated with me. But thank you both so much for your time today. It's been such a pleasure to talk through your lived experience.
Thank you so much, Justine. It's been an absolute pleasure.
For more of our podcasts, visit our website at podcast.tedlearning.co.uk, or you can find us on most podcast platforms.